I'm reading from George Zimmel, Sociability. It was published in American Journal of Sociology in 1949, this translation, but it was originally in German. It was written in 1910. There is an old conflict over the nature of society. One side mystically exaggerates its significance, contending that only through society is human life endowed with reality. The other regards it as a mere abstract concept by means of which an observer draws the realities, which are individual human beings, into a whole, as one calls trees and brooks, houses and meadows, a landscape. However one decides this conflict, he must allow society to be a reality in a double sense. On the one hand, are the individuals in their directly perceptible existence, the bearers of the processes of association, who are united by these processes into the higher unity, which one calls society. On the other hand, the interests which, living in the individual, motivate such union, economic and ideal interests, warlike and erotic, religious and charitable. To satisfy such urges, and to attain such purposes, arise the innumerable forms of social life, all the with one another, for one another, in one another, against one another, and through one another, in state and commune, in church and economic associations, in family and clubs. The energy effects of atoms upon each other bring matter into the innumerable forms which we see as things. Just so, the impulses and interests which a man experiences in himself and which push him out towards other men bring about all the forms of association by which mere sum of separate individuals are made into a society. Within this constellation, called society, or out of it, there develops a special sociological structure corresponding to those of art and play, which draw their form from these realities, but nevertheless leave their reality behind them. It may be an open question whether the concept of a play impulse or an artistic impulse possesses explanatory value. At least it directs attention to the fact that in every play or artistic activity, there is contained a common element not affected by their differences of content. Some residue of satisfaction lies in gymnastics, as in card playing, in music, and in plastic art, something which has nothing to do with the peculiarities of music or plastic art as such, but only with the fact that both of the latter are art and both of the former are play. A common element, a likeness of psychological reaction and need, is found in all these various things, something easily distinguishable from the special interest which gives each its distinction. In the same sense, one may speak of an impulse to sociability in man. To be sure, it is for the sake of special needs and interests that men unite in economic associations or blood fraternities, in cult societies or robber bands. It's robber bands. But above and beyond their special content, all these associations are accompanied by a feeling for, by a satisfaction in, the very fact that one is associated with others and that the solitariness of the individual is resolved into togetherness, a union with others. Of course, this feeling can, in individual cases, be nullified by contrary psychological factors. Association can be felt as a mere burden, endured for the sake of our objective aims. But typically there is involved in all effective motives for association a feeling of the worth of association as such, a drive which presses towards this form of existence, and often only later calls forth that objective content which carries the particular association along. And as that which I have called the artistic impulse draws its form from the complexes of perceivable things and builds this form into a special structure corresponding to the artistic impulse, so also the impulse to sociability distills, as it were, out of the realities of social life the pure essence of association, of the associative process as a value and a satisfaction. It thereby constitutes what we call sociability in the narrower sense. It is no mere accident of language that all sociability, even the purely spontaneous, if it is to have meaning and stability, lays such great value on form, on good form. For good form is mutual self-definition. interaction of the elements through which a unity is made. And since in sociability, the concrete motives bound up by life with life goals fall away, so must the pure form, the free-playing, interacting interdependence of individuals stand out so much the more strongly and operate with so much the greater effect. And what joins art with play now appears in the likeness of both to sociability. From the realities of life, play draws its great essential themes, the chase and cunning, the proving of physical and mental powers, the contest and reliance on chance and the favor of forces which one cannot influence, freed of substance, through which these activities make up the seriousness of life, play gets its cheerfulness, but also that symbolic significance which distinguishes it from pure pastime. And just this will show itself more and more as the essence of sociability, that it makes up its substance from numerous fundamental forms of serious relationships among men, a substance, however, spared the frictional relations of real life. But out of its formal relations to real life, sociability, and the more so as it approaches pure sociability, takes on a symbolically playing fullness of life and a significance which a superficial rationalism always seeks only in the content. Rationalism, finding no content there, seeks to do away with sociability as empty idleness, as did the savant who asked concerning a work of art, what does that prove? It is nevertheless not without significance that in many, perhaps in all, European languages, the word society, or Gesellschaft, designates a sociable gathering. The political, the economic, the purposive society of any sort is, to be sure, always, quote, society. But only the sociable gathering is, quote, society without qualifying adjectives, because it alone presents the pure abstract play of form. All the specific contents of the one-sided and qualified societies being dissolved away. There's a note here. The point is more striking in German, where the word Gesellschaft means both society and party in terms of a sociable gathering. But it does mean a party. Okay, there's political parties. No, a society is sort of a collection. It's like voluntary association. It's like a group of people that get together to have fun or interact. But it is something structured, repeating, and happens every week. It's the lasting group interaction. Sociability is then the play form of association. It is related to the content determined concreteness of association as art is related to reality. Now, the great problem of association comes to a solution possible only in sociability. The problem is that of the measure of significance and accent which belongs to the individual as such in and as against the social milieu. Since sociability in its pure form has no ulterior end, no content, and no result outside itself, it is oriented completely about personalities. Since nothing but the satisfaction of the impulse to sociability, although with a resonance left over, is to be gained, the process remains, in its conditions as in its results, strictly limited to the personal bearers. The personal traits of amiability, breeding, cordiality, and attractiveness of all kinds determine the character of purely sociable association. But precisely because it all is oriented about them, the personalities must not emphasize themselves too individually, where real interests, cooperating or clashing, determine the social form. They provide of themselves that the individual shall not present his peculiarities and individuality with too much abandon and aggressiveness. But where the restraint is wanting, if association is to be possible at all, there must prevail another restriction of personal pushing, a restriction springing solely out of the form of the association. It is for this reason that the sense of tact is of such special significance to society, for it guides the self-regulation of the individual in his personal relations to others, where no outer or directly egoistic interests provide regulation. And perhaps it is the specific function of tact to mark out for individual impulsiveness, for the ego, and for outside demands, these limits which the rights of others require. A very remarkable sociological structure appears at this point. In sociability, whatever the personality has of objective importance, of features which have their orientation towards something outside the circle, must not interfere. Riches and social position, learning and fame, exceptional capacities and merits of the individual have no role in sociability, or at most as a slight nuance of the immateriality with which alone reality dares penetrate into the artificial structure of sociability. As these objective qualities which gather about the personality, so also must the most purely and deeply personal qualities be excluded from sociability. The most personal things, character, mood, and fate, have thus no place in it. It is tactless to bring in personal humor, good or ill, excitement and depression, the light and shadow of one's inner life. Where a connection begun on the sociable level and not necessarily a superficial or conventional one finally comes to center about personal values, it loses the essential quality of sociability and becomes an association determined by a content, not unlike a business or religion relation, for which contact, exchange, and speech are but instruments for ulterior ends, while for sociability they are the whole meaning and content of the social processes. This exclusion of the personal reaches into even the most external matters. A lady would not want to appear in such extreme décolletage, in a really personal, intimately friendly situation with one or two men, as she would in a large company without any embarrassment. In the latter, she would not feel herself personally involved in the same measure and could thereby abandon herself to the impersonal freedom of the mask. For she is, in larger company, herself to be sure, but not quite completely herself, since she is only an element in a formally constituted gathering. A man, taken as a whole, is, so to speak, a somewhat unformed complex of contents, powers, and potentialities. Only according to the motivations and relationships of a changing existence is he articulated into a differentiated, defined structure. As an economic and political agent, as a member or of a family or of a profession, he is, so to speak, an ad hoc construction. His life material is ever determined by a special idea poured into a special mold whose relatively independent life is, to be sure, nourished from the common but somewhat undefinable source of energy, the ego. In this sense, the man, as a social creature, is also a unique structure, occurring in no other connection. On the one hand, he has removed all the objective qualities of the personality and entered into the structure of sociability with nothing but his capacities, attractions, and interests of his pure humanity. He's talking about, like, because nobody has any, like, prior knowledge of him, you leave that intimate stuff behind, a lot of the personal details, and you just are a role in that situation. On the other hand, this structure stops short of the purely subjective and inward parts of his personality. That discretion which is one's first demand upon others in sociability is also required of one's own ego, because a breach of it in either direction causes the sociological artifact of sociability to break down into a sociological naturalism. One can therefore speak of an upper and lower sociability threshold for the individual. At the moment when people direct their attention towards objective content and purpose, as well as in the moment when the absolutely personal and subjective matters of the individual enter freely into the phenomenon, sociability is no longer the central and controlling principle, but at most a formalistic and outwardly instrumental principle. From this negative definition of the nature of sociability through boundaries and thresholds, however, one can perhaps find the positive motif. Kant set it up as the principle of law that everyone should have the measure of freedom which could exist along with the freedom of every other person. If one stands by the sociability impulse as the source or also as the substance of sociability. The following is the principle according to which it is constituted. Everyone should have as much satisfaction of this impulse as is consonant with the satisfaction of the impulse for all others. If one expresses this not in terms of the impulse, but rather in terms of success, the principle of sociability may be formalized thus. Everyone should guarantee to the other that maximum of sociable values, joy, relief, vivacity, which is consonant with the maximum of value he receives. As justice upon the Kantian basis is thoroughly democratic, so likewise this principle shows the democratic structure of all sociability, which to be sure every social stratum can realize only within itself, and which so often makes sociability between members of different social classes burdensome and painful. But even among social equals, the democracy of their sociability is a play. Sociability creates, if one will, an ideal sociological world, for in it, so say the emancipated principles, the pleasure of the individual is always contingent upon the joy of others. Here, by definition, no one can have the satisfaction at the cost of contrary experiences on the part of others. In other forms of association, such lack of reciprocity is excluded only by the ethical imperative which governed them, but not by their own immanent nature. This world of sociability, the only one in which a democracy of equals is possible without friction, is an artificial world, made up of beings who have renounced both the objective and the purely personal features of the intensity and extensiveness of life in order to bring about among themselves a pure interaction, free of any disturbing material accent. If we now have the conception that we enter into sociability purely as human beings, as that which we really are, lacking all the burdens, the agitations, the inequalities with which real life disturbs the purity of our picture, it is because modern life is overburdened with objective content and material demands. Ridding ourselves of this burden in sociable circles, we believe we return to our natural personal being, and overlook the fact that this personal aspect also does not consist in its full uniqueness and natural completeness, but only in a certain reserve and stylizing of the sociable man. In earlier epochs, when a man did not so depend upon the purposive, objective content of his associations, his, quote, formal personality stood out more clearly against his personal existence. Hence, personal bearing in the society of earlier times was much more ceremonially, rigidly, and interpersonally regulated than now. This reduction of the personal periphery, of the measure of significance which homogeneous interaction with others allowed the individual, has been followed by a swing to the opposite extreme. Today, one may even find in society that courtesy by which the strong, outstanding person not only places himself on a level with the weaker, but goes so far as to assume the attitude that the weaker is more worthy and superior. If association itself is interaction, it appears in its purest and most stylized form when it goes on among equals, just as symmetry and balance are the most outstanding forms of artistic stylizing of visible elements. Inasmuch as sociability is the abstraction of association, an abstraction of the character of art or of play, it demands the purest, most transparent, most engaging kind of interaction, that among equals. It must, because of its very nature, posit beings who give up so much of their objective content, who are so modified in both their outward and their inner significance, that they are sociably equal, and every one of them can win sociability values for himself only under the condition that the others interacting with him can also win them. It is a game in which one acts as though all were equal, as though he especially esteemed everyone. This is just as far from being a lie as is play or art in all their departures from reality. But the instant the intentions and events of practical reality enter into the speech and behavior of sociability, it does become a lie. just as a painting does when it attempts panorama fashion to be taken for reality, that which is right and proper within the self-contained life of sociability, concerned only with the immediate play of its forms, becomes a lie when this is mere pretense, which in reality is guided by purposes of quite another sort than the sociable or is used to conceal such purposes. And indeed, sociability may easily get entangled with real life. It is an obvious corollary that everything may be subsumed under sociability, which one can call sociological play form. Above all, play itself, which assumes a large place in the sociability of all epochs. The expression, quote, social game, is significant in the deeper sense which I have indicated. The entire interaction or associational complex among men, the desire to gain advantage, trade, formation of parties, and the desire to win from another, the movement between opposition and cooperation, outwitting and revenge, all this, fraught with purposive content in the serious affairs of reality, in play, leads a life carried along only and completely by the stimulus of these functions. For even when play turns out a money prize, it is not the prize, which indeed could be won in many other ways, which is the specific point of the play, but the attraction for the true sportsman lies in the dynamics and the chances of that sociologically significant form of activity itself. The social game has a deeper double meaning, that it is played not only in a society and as its outer bearer, but that with its help, people actually play society. Further, in the sociology of the sexes, eroticism has elaborated a form of play, coquetry, which finds in sociability its lightest, most playful, and yet its widest realization. If the erotic question between the sexes turns about consent or denial, whose objects are naturally of endless variety and degree, and by no means only of strictly physiological nature, So is it the essence of feminine coquetry to play hinted consent and hinted denial against each other, to draw the man on without letting matters come to a decision, to rebuff him without making him lose all hope? What is this? The coquette brings her attractiveness to its climax by letting the man hang on the verge of getting what he wants without letting it become too serious for herself. Conduct swings between yes and no without stopping at one or the other. She thus playfully shows the simple and pure form of erotic decision and can bring its polar opposites together in a quite integrated behavior, since the decisive and fateful content which would bring it to one of the two decisions by definition does not enter into coquetry. And this freedom from all the weight of firm content and residual reality gives coquetry that character of vacillation, of distance, of the ideal, which allows one to speak with some right of the art, not of the arts, of coquetry. In order, however, for coquetry to spread as so natural a growth on the soil of sociability as experience shows it to be, it must be countered by a special attitude on the part of men. Huh, what? So long as the man denies himself the stimulation of coquetry, or so long as he is, on the contrary, merely a victim who is involuntarily carried along by her vacillations from a half-yes to a half-no, so long does coquetry lack the adequate structure of sociability. It lacks that free interaction and equivalence of the elements, which is the fundamental condition of sociability. The latter appears only when the man desires nothing more than this free moving play, in which something definitely erotic lurks only as a remote symbol, and when he does not get his pleasure in these gestures and preliminaries from erotic desire or fear of it. Coquetry, as it unfolds its grace on the heights of sociable cultivation, has left behind the reality of erotic desire, of consent or denial, and become a play of shadow pictures of these serious matters. Where the latter enter or lurk, the whole process become a private affair of the two persons, played out on the level of reality, under the sociological sign of sociability, however, in which the essential orientation of the person to the fullness of life does not enter. Coquetry is the teasing or even ironic play with which eroticism has distilled the pure essence of its interaction out from the from its substantive or individual content. As sociability plays at the forms of society, so coquetry plays out the forms of eroticism. In what measure sociability realizes to the full the abstraction of the forms of sociological interaction otherwise significant because of their content, and gives them, now turning about themselves, so to speak, a shadow body, is revealed finally in the most extensive instrument of all human common life, conversation. The decisive point is expressed in the quite banal experience that in the serious affairs of life, men talk about the talk for the sake of the content which they wish to impart or about which they want to come to an understanding. In sociability, talking is an end in itself. In purely sociable conversation, the content is merely the indispensable carrier of the stimulation which the lively exchange of talk as such unfolds. All the forms with which this exchange develops, argument and the appeals to the norms recognized by both parties, the conclusion of peace through compromise and the discovery of common convictions, the thankful acceptance of the new and the pairing off of that on which no understanding is to be hoped for, all these forms of conversational interaction, otherwise in the service of innumerable contents and purposes of human intercourse, have hear their meaning in themselves, that is to say, in the excitement of the play of relations which they establish between individuals, binding and loosening, conquering and being vanquished, giving and taking. In order that this play may return its self-sufficiency at the level of pure form, the content must receive no weight on its own. As soon as the discussion gets businesslike, it's no longer sociable. It turns its compass point around as soon as the verification of a truth becomes its purpose. Its character as sociable converse is disturbed just as when it turns into a serious argument. The form of the common search for truth, the form of the argument, may occur, but it must not permit the seriousness of the momentary content to become its substance any more than one may put a piece of three-dimensional reality into the perspective of a painting. Not that the content of sociable conversation is a matter of indifference. It must be interesting, gripping, even significant. Only it is not the purpose of the conversation that these qualities should square with objective results, which stand by definition outside the conversation. Outwardly, therefore, two conversations may run a similar course, but only that one of them is sociable, in which the subject matter with all its value and stimulation finds its justification, its place, and its purpose, only in the functional play of conversation as such, in the form of repartee with its special, unique significance. It therefore inheres in the nature of sociable conversation that its object matter can change lightly and quickly. For since the matter is only the means, it has an entirely interchangeable and accidental character which inheres in means as against fixed purposes. Thus, sociability offers, as was said, perhaps the only case in which talk is a legitimate end in itself. For by the fact that it is two-sided, indeed with the possible exception of looking each other over, the purest and most sublimated form of mutuality among all sociological phenomena, besides this exception, it becomes the most adequate fulfillment of a relation, which is, so to speak, nothing but relationship, in which even that which is otherwise pure form of interaction is its own self-sufficient content. It results from this whole complex that also the telling of tales, witticisms, anecdotes, although often a stopgap and evidence of conversational poverty, still can show a fine tact in which all the motives of sociability are apparent. For, in the first place, the conversation is by this means kept above all individual intimacy, beyond everything purely personal, which would not fit into the categories of sociability, This objective element is brought in not for the sake of its content, but in the interest of sociability. That said, that something is said and accepted is not an end in itself, but a mere means to maintain the liveliness, the mutual understanding, and the common consciousness of the group. Not only thereby is it given a content which all can share, but it is a gift of the individual to the whole, behind which the giver can remain invisible. The finest sociably told story is that in which the narrator allows his own person to remain completely in the background. The most effective story holds itself in the happy balance of the sociable ethic, in which the subjectively individual, as well as the objectively substantive, have dissolved themselves completely in the service of pure sociability. It is hereby indicated that sociability is the play form also for the ethical forces of concrete society. The great problems faced before these forces are that the individual has to fit himself into a whole system and live for it. That, however, outside of the system, values and enhancement must flow back to him, that the life of the individual is but a means for the ends of the whole, the life of the whole but an instrument for the purposes of the individual. Sociability carries the seriousness, indeed the frequent tragedy of these requirements, over into its shadow world, in which there is no friction because shadows cannot impinge upon one another. If it is, further, the ethical task of association to make this coming together and the separation of its elements an exact and just expression of their inner relations, determined by the wholeness of their lives, so within sociability, this freedom and adequacy are freed of their concrete and substantively deeper limitations. The manner in which groups form and break up at parties and conversations spin itself out, deepens, loosens, cuts itself off purely according to impulse and opportunity, this is a miniature picture of the social ideal that one might call the freedom of bondage. If all association and separation shall be strictly appropriate representation of inner realities, so are the latter here fallen by the way, and only the former phenomenon is left, whose play, obedient to its own laws, whose closed charm represents aesthetically that moderation which the seriousness of realities otherwise demands of its ethical decision. This total interpretation of sociability is evidently realized by certain historical developments. In the early German Middle Ages, we find knightly fraternities which were founded by friendly patrician families. The religious and practical ends of these unions seem to have been lost rather early, and in the 14th century, the chivalrous interests and conduct remained their only specific content. Soon after, this also disappears, and there remain only purely sociable unions of aristocratic strata. Here, the sociability apparently develops as the residuum of a society determined by a content, as the residuum which, because the content had been lost, can exist only in a form and in the forms of with one another and for one another. That the essential existence of these forms can have only the inner nature of play, or, reaching deeper, of art, appears even more clearly in the court society of the Ancien Régime. Here, by the falling off of the concrete life content, which was sucked away by the French aristocracy, in some measure by the monarchy, there developed free-moving forms towards which the consciousness of this class was crystallized, forms whose force, definitions, and relations were purely sociable and in no way symbols or functions of the real meanings and intensities of persons and institutions. The etiquette of court society became an end in itself. It etiquetted no content any longer, but had elaborated immanent laws comparable to those of art, which have validity only from the viewpoint of art and do not at all have the purpose of imitating faithfully and strikingly the reality of the model, that is, of things outside art. With this phenomenon, sociability attains its most sovereign expression, but at the same time verges on caricature. To be sure, it is its nature to shut out realities from the interactive relations of men and build its castle in air according to the formal laws of these relations, which move within the themselves and recognize no purpose outside themselves. But the deep running source from which the empire takes its energies is nonetheless to be sought not in these self-regulating forms, but only in the vitality of real individuals, in their sensitivities and attractions, in the fullness of their impulses and convictions. All sociability is but a symbol of life, as it shows itself in the flow of a lightly amusing play, but even so, a symbol of life whose likeness it only so far alters, as is required by the distance from it gained in the play, exactly as also the freest and most fantastic art, the furthest from all reality, nourishes itself from a deep and true relation to reality, if it is not to be empty and lying. If sociability cuts off completely the threads which bind it to real life and out of which it spins its admittedly stylized web, it turns from play to empty farce, to a lifeless schematization proud of its woodenness. From this context, it becomes apparent that men can complain, both justly and unjustly, of the superficiality of social intercourse. It is one of the most pregnant facts of mental life that if we weld certain elements taken from the whole of being into a realm of their own, which is governed by its own laws and not by those of the whole, this realm, if completely cut off from the life of the whole, can display in its inner realization an empty nature suspended in the air, but then often altered only by imponderables. Precisely in this state of removal from all immediate reality, its deeper nature can appear more completely, more integrated and meaningful than any attempt to comprehend it realistically and without taking distance. According as the former or the latter experience predominates, will one's own life, running its own course according to its own norms, be a formal, meaningless, dead thing, or a symbolic play in whose aesthetic charm all the finest and most highly sublimated dynamics of social existence and its riches are gathered. In all art, in all the symbolism of the religious life, in great measure even in the complex formulations of science, we are thrown back upon this belief, upon this feeling, that autonomies of mere parts of observed reality, that the combinations of certain superficial elements possesses a relation to the depth and wholeness of life, which, although not easy to formulate, makes such a part the bearer and the representative of the fundamental reality. From this, we may understand the saving grace and blessing effect of those realms built out of the pure forms of existence, for in them we are released from life, have it still. The sight of the sea frees us inwardly, not in spite of, but because of the fact that it, in its rushing up to only to recede, its receding only to rise again, in the play and counterplay of its waves, the whole of life is stylized to the simplest expression of its dynamic, quite free from all reality which one may experience and from all baggage of individual fate, whose final meaning seems nevertheless to flow into this stark picture. Just so, art perhaps reveals the secrets of life, that we save ourselves not only by simply looking away from it, but precisely in that, in the apparently self-governing play of its forms, we construct and experience the meaning and the forces of its deeper reality, but without the reality itself. Sociability would not hold for so many thoughtful men who feel in every moment the pressure of life, this emancipating and saving exhilaration, if it were only a flight from life, the mere momentary lifting of its seriousness. It can often enough be only this negative thing, a conventionalism and inwardly lifeless exchange of formulas. So perhaps in the ancient regime, where gloomy anxiety over a threatening reality drove men into pure escape, into severance from the powers of actual life, the freeing and lightening, however, that precisely the more thoughtful man finds in sociability is this, that association and exchange of stimulus in which all the tasks and the whole weight of life are realized here is consumed in an artistic play, in that simultaneous sublimation and dilution in which the heavily freighted forces of reality are felt only as from a distance, their weight fleeting in a charm.